Folks, I'm going to introduce Dr. David Suzuki. Most of you know him, but this is being recorded and will be broadcast. Sometimes I speak on this issue, and people were critical of our position on GMOs. They say, David Suzuki doesn't know what he's talking about. I wish he'd read something about genetics. Sorry. I was at an eight-hour meeting with a group of farmers in Ontario. I was the only anti-GMO speaker in the room, and they weren't friendly. What can I say? Anyway, David Suzuki is a geneticist. His genetics lab was at one point the biggest in Canada, and he did write the book, the most widely used genetics textbook in the United States. So for those who have questions, yes, he does know a bit about it. David Suzuki.
Thank you. He got it wrong. Our textbook is the most widely used genetics textbook in the world. And I'm very proud of that. I'm delighted to be here tonight, and it's a great audience, so I'm very pleased that the previous speakers have all basically done my job for me. They've covered the ground. So with your forgiveness, I'd like to indulge myself by telling you a story about me. I was born in Vancouver in 1936. My mother and father were also born in Vancouver much earlier in the past century. In 1942, our family was declared potential enemy of our country. All of our rights as citizens were suspended, our property confiscated, and our bank accounts frozen. We were incarcerated in camps in an abandoned mining town called Slocan City for 3 years. And then as the end of the war was coming about, we were expelled from the province. The crime for which we lost all rights of citizenship and spent 3 years incarcerated was the sharing of genes with the enemy. My genes had come to Canada two generations before. Pearl Harbor, our evacuation, incarceration, and expulsion from British Columbia were the defining events in my life. They gave me a lifelong abhorrence of looking at pictures of myself or looking in the mirror, because my slitty eyes were a reminder that I was the enemy. And they gave me a lifelong knee-jerk response to bigotry and racism. After the war, of course, our family was wiped out. We were absolutely impoverished. The way out of our poverty was through hard work and education. And I was very fortunate in receiving a large scholarship to an outstanding American liberal arts college in Massachusetts. And it was while I was an honor student in biology that I took a course in genetics. And I fell madly, madly in love with genetics. Ultimately went on to get a PhD in another American university in genetics. I returned to Canada for reasons that had less to do with science than my involvement in civil rights. I couldn't stand living in a country in which there was so much naked racism, although returning to Canada was a country that had kicked me out. Nevertheless, I felt Canada was my home and a place where it was possible to do things. And the first class I taught was at the University of Alberta, and it was an ag class. And I bitched and moaned that I was given this damn class with agriculture students. It was the best class I ever had. There were 15 students, all but one were males. They played hard and they worked hard. The thing about them is they kept asking me questions about cattle breeding and grain breeding, stuff I'd never learned, because I was a hotshot basic geneticist. Wasn't interested in all this applied stuff. But because of their questions, they made me go into the literature and learn a lot of stuff I hadn't learned about animal and plant breeding. It was too cold in Edmonton, so I left after 1 year. I came to Vancouver, to UBC. And my classes, I'd say most of my classes that I taught in genetics were half, at least, pre-meds. And those pre-meds, aside from being the biggest pain in the ass you can imagine, Those pre-meds kept asking me stuff about human genetics, you know, and again, I was a hotshot fruit fly geneticist. What did I care about people? They asked me about things like cloning and genetic engineering and eugenics, stuff I, again, had never learned, even though I had gone to an outstanding undergraduate liberal arts college. I hadn't been taught any of this stuff, and I had to read. And to my amazement, I discovered a whole history of genetics that had been deliberately expurgated from the kind of education that I had received at a top liberal arts college. I discovered that in the early part of the 20th century, exhilarated at the discoveries that were being made in this infant field of genetics, geneticists felt they had their hands on the levers of life, and that with this kind of power, they would now be able to direct the evolution of human beings, eliminating the less desirable genetic combinations and encouraging the better genes into the population. This was called eugenics. Eugenics was legitimated by the fact that the outstanding geneticists of the day belonged to eugenic societies. They taught eugenics courses in universities. There were eugenics textbooks and eugenics journals. So it had all of the trappings of a legitimate science. And one of the leading geneticists of the day was a professor, Edward East, at Harvard. He became president of the Genetic Society of America, the most prestigious genetic society in the world. He wrote a text in eugenics, and here's a bit of what he said in his eugenics text. In reality, the Negro is inferior to the white. This is not hypothesis or supposition. It is a crude statement of actual fact. Now, the amazing thing about this is you know that when you start using words like inferior or superior, it's got nothing to do with science anymore. These are value judgments. But this man, this brilliant man, had confused his values with scientifically demonstrated fact. It was because of claims of people like Edward East and many others that in the United States, we saw very progressive legislation, eugenics acts, which Canada also enacted, and in Alberta were enforced right up until close to the 1970s. That's why Ralph Klein got into trouble a while ago, because he was so niggardly, he didn't want to give any kind of compensation to people that had been sterilized under the eugenics acts. But the public outrage made him change his mind in less than 2 weeks. Under the eugenics acts, people in mental institutions were sterilized with a genetics rationale. In the United States, there were restrictions on immigration from countries deemed to have inferior racial stock. And in many states in the U.S., there were anti-miscegenation laws, laws prohibiting interracial marriage. And as I began to delve into this hidden history of my discipline, I discovered to my horror that it had been the kinds of claims made by geneticists that had set the stage, in fact, for the incarceration of Japanese Canadians. Let me quote something from one of our members of parliament from British Columbia, A.W. Neill, who said in 1937, and this is in Hansard, let me quote, "To cross an individual of the white race with an individual of a yellow race is to produce, in 9 cases out of 10, a mongrel wastrel with the worst qualities of both races." Well, it isn't quite a 3-to-1 Mendelian ratio, but here was a guy that actually tried to put a numerical value, 9 times out of 10. Do you think that sprang out of the minds of a bigot? Obviously, it had been the ground had been prepared by the kinds of claims geneticists were making. He said in 1941, and I quote, to the Prime Minister of Canada, "We in British Columbia are firmly convinced that once a Jap, always a Jap." In other words, it doesn't matter how many generations you're born in this country, your genes determine that you have the characteristics, in this case, with the enemy. In the United States, the general put in charge of the Japanese-American evacuation was a man named John DeWitt. And in February of 1942, this is what DeWitt stated as his position. "Racial affinities are not severed by migration. The Japanese race is an enemy race. And while many second and third generation Japanese born on United States soil, possessed of American citizenship, have become, and he quotes, Americanized, the racial strains are undiluted. It therefore follows that along the vital Pacific coast, over 112,000 potential enemies of Japanese extraction are at large today. That was the rationale then that led to the incarceration of Japanese Americans and Canadians along the West Coast. And I began to read further and discovered that one of the leading countries in genetics in the 1920s and 30s had been Germany. And that it was a leading geneticist, in fact, whose claims led the Nazi Party to advance some of its most progressive legislation, including the Nazi Race Purification Acts. And I discovered to my horror that Joseph Mengele, the infamous doctor at Auschwitz, was a geneticist. And that while he was at Auschwitz, he had two peer-reviewed grants to do his studies on twins in that death camp. It was ultimately a revulsion against the discovery of what had led of the Holocaust that led geneticists at the end of the Second World War to now back off their claims of so much of human behavior being genetically determined. Now it was much more popular in 1945 to say, no, it's the environment that really is dictating most of the human fate. I think it's, for me, the revelations of the intimate relationship between this great discipline that I had fallen in love with and the course of human history was an important lesson. And the shocking thing to me was that it was being deliberately expunged from the kind of courses that are being taught to prospective geneticists. And of course, if we don't have any idea of history, it's going to be for sure that we're going to make the same mistakes. One hears today the same kinds of claims that are being discovered. Of course, we have a very potent tool now, the capacity to manipulate DNA at will. And it's an intoxicating technology to have. But the same claims are being made as were made back in the 1920s and 30s. Science was advancing in the 1940s and 50s. And scientists were saying that we have the ability to push back the curtains of ignorance, to reveal the deepest secrets of the cosmos. And as we come to understand nature's secrets, life will get better and better for humankind because we can apply it for our own benefit. Well, social historian Joseph Haberer at Cornell examined the history of science and published his report in Science in the 60s. And what he said was at one point, modern science has been singularly devoid of any serious concern with the fundamental questions, for example, those involving the relations between means and ends. Its overriding instrumentalism has been expressed in its desire to control and dominate nature, almost as an end in itself. He said later in the article, what becomes evident is that scientific leaders, when faced with a choice between the imperatives of conscience and power, nationalism and internationalism, justice and patriotism, invariably gravitated toward power, nationalism, and patriotism. By the 1960s, genetics was clearly headed for spectacular discoveries that have ramifications for human beings. And in the 1960s, an article appeared in Science by a man named Roland Hotchkiss, who was one of the leading geneticists of that day at Rockefeller University. And he wrote, many of us feel an instinctive revulsion at meddling with the finely balanced factors that make an individual what he is. Yet I believe it will surely be done or attempted. The pathway will be built on a combination of altruism, private profit, and ignorance. And the editor of Science wrote an accompanying editorial, and he said, I agree, that is, he agrees with Hotchkiss, I agree. Geneticists will have high ideals for the application of their knowledge. In practice, power to apply that knowledge, as was the case with nuclear energy, will come to rest in other hands. A very prescient statement. In the 1970s, Arthur Jensen, an educational psychologist, published an article in the Harvard Review stating that there was a genetic basis for IQ. And suddenly, we began to see a movement again to the notion that genes were a dominant feature of our of the way that we became. He was followed by people like Hans Eysenck, a psychologist, stating that criminality was genetically determined, and Richard Herrnstein, a psychologist at Harvard, stating that IQ and the meritocracy was that social class was really genetically determined. By the late 1970s, it was clear that there was enormous potential from the new tools of genetic manipulation, called at that time recombinant DNA. Indeed, there was pressure in my lab to get involved. I wrote a series of columns for a magazine for the National Research Council, and in August 1977, this is what I wrote. For young scientists who are under enormous pressure to publish to secure a faculty position, tenure, or promotion, and for established scientists with Nobelitis, the siren's call of recombinant DNA is irresistible. In my own laboratory, there is now considerable pressure to clone DNA sequences from Drosophila in E. coli. My students and postdocs take experiments and techniques for granted that were undreamed of 5 or 10 years ago. We feel we're on the verge of really understanding the arrangement, structure, and regulation of genes and chromosomes. In this climate of enthusiasm and excitement, scientists are finding the debate over regulation and long-term implications of recombinant DNA a frustrating roadblock to getting on with the research. I wrote later in 1978, I can appreciate the pressures that are brought to bear to stifle dissent within the scientific community. Peer approval brings with it invitations to give lectures, to speak at symposia and honorary positions in scientific organizations. The driving priorities of young scientists are to get and keep good-sized grants and achieve recognition, tenure, and promotion. Therefore, outspoken criticism is understandably rare in this group, and they depend on people higher up in the scientific hierarchy to set their objectives. What am I saying? Not that scientists are evil, malicious, or irresponsible. Rather, that our personal priorities, membership in a vested interest group, ambitions and goals prevent us from objectively weighing the social against personal consequences of our work. So I made a public declaration then in a column. Can the important questions be addressed objectively when one has such high stakes in continuing the work? I doubt it. Therefore, I feel compelled to take the position that no such experiments on recombinant DNA will be done in my lab. Reports on such experiments will not acknowledge my grants, and I will not knowingly be listed as an author of a paper involving recombinant DNA. You see, I had achieved far more in science than I ever dreamed or hoped. So I felt that some of us whose careers and reputations were not in jeopardy had to forego this work in order to take part as scientists in the discussions of the moral and ethical questions, free from the bias of vested interests in the work. Scientists working for the nuclear, tobacco, scientists working for the nuclear, tobacco, or petrochemical industries speak from a perspective of their employers. And there is no reason to suppose that scientists in biotechnology will be any different. Eventually, I stopped taking government money altogether, so I would be free from any kind of pressure. Following that announcement I wouldn't get involved in this area, I eventually left the lab. But I continued to think and write about the issues. I wrote an entire book that became a bestseller called Genethics: The Ethics of Engineering Life. I wrote that with Peter Knudsen, science writer. I wrote numerous columns on the social implications of genetics and have them in a number of books that I've published. Yet when I began to make public statements a couple of years ago about GMOs and how we shouldn't be releasing them into the wild or certainly eating them, I was attacked for lacking credibility. As if people who have vested interests in this huge area are more credible than someone who has deliberately stayed away from getting involved. The shocking and painful thing to me is that my colleagues, who should know better, should realize with a revolutionary technology, and this is revolutionary, must be prepared to undergo extraordinary discussion, debate, and controversy. Surely this is a time at which there should be a ferment of discussion. And yet what is happening within the profession is a clamping down on any kind of dissent. The people you see on this panel, Maywan and Anne, are real heroes because they are among a small group of people We'll get into this. Let me just finish with some quotes from a remarkable paper that was written by Ted Rozsak in Daedalus. I think it was in the 1980s. Dr. Faustus, Dr. Frankenstein, Dr. Moreau, Dr. Jekyll, Dr. Cyclops, Dr. Caligari, Dr. Strangelove. The scientist who does not face up to the warning in this persistent folklore of mad scientists is himself the worst enemy of science. In these images of our popular culture resides a legitimate public fear of the scientist's stripped down, depersonalized conception of knowledge. A fear that our scientists, well-intentioned and decent men and women all, will go on being titans who create monsters. If people want more from science than fact and theory, it is because there lingers on in all of us a need for gnosis. That's G-N-O-S-I-S. We want to know the meaning of our existence, and we want that meaning to ennoble our lives in a way that makes an enduring difference in the universe. Where did the doctors, he's speaking of Frankenstein, the thing is, Frankenstein was the doctor, not the monster. Where did the doctor's great project go wrong? Not in his intentions, which were beneficent, but in the dangerous haste and egotistic myopia with which he pursued his goal. It is both a beautiful and a terrible aspect of our humanity, this capacity to be carried away by an idea. For all the best reasons, Victor Frankenstein wished to create a new and better human type. What he knew was the secret of the creature's physical assemblage. He knew how to manipulate the material parts of nature to achieve an astonishing result. What he did not know was the secret of personality in nature. Yet he raced ahead, eager to play God without knowing God's most divine mystery. So he created something that was soulless. And when that monstrous thing appealed to him for the one gift that might redeem it from monstrosity, Frankenstein discovered to his horror that for all his genius, it was not within him to provide that gift. Nothing in his science comprehended it. The gift was love. The doctor knew everything there was to know about his creature, except how to love it as a person. Thank you.
That was geneticist Dr. David Suzuki. You're listening to a panel on biotechnology, Big Money, Bad Science, recorded November 10th in Vancouver, Canada.
Am I an animal so programmable, a Pavlov dog in a revolving door, or a human spirit that has got no limit, and I ain't gonna double for a dunce no more? Say that I won't, but I probably will, cause they got my number and they're ringing it still, singing, heal the hunger in your soul, with a brand new filling for a brand new hole, and it's all for my freedom of choice. That a thousand satellites got one voice, or a TV shopper who remotely votes, channel hopping in the cabin of a sinking boat. Titanic, what's the panic bullshit now? Slave or citizen, same old shit again. Got a lot of what I never used to need, while all I'm cherishing is perishing, fed to the fetish of a great white greed. Greed in the boardroom, bigger than God, using a woman as a wink and nod, and I brought to the herd that are driving by.
You can have my body if you buy my lie.
Somebody in this neighborhood ought to take those billboards out for good. Ought to run those dealers out of town. Ought to take back the power and hand it around.
Start planning for an insurrection now.
I'm not a terrorist, maybe an anarchist. A nice bloke doesn't want to hurt no one, but if we don't stop...
We'll start with the microphone on the balcony, and then we'll go to the microphone here. Please.
Thank you. Thanks to all the panelists and to all the people who organized today's event. I've learned a lot. It's kind of overwhelming. I understand that in Europe there's been a great deal of activity around genetic engineering issues, and I'm wondering if any of the panelists could address what's been going on there and what some of the successes are and how they've managed to attain those so that we can perhaps model our activities here.
Well, it's people's action. I mean, most of the action came from the grassroots. Really, these are old ladies like me, you know, old retired ladies. But you go to demos, and grandmas and granddaughters will be in the same demo. And these are people who have never been involved in political action before. And they just organize. Local meetings, they write to MPs, they write to the supermarkets. The young people came out and did demonstrations in the supermarkets. They go and rip up the crops. I'm not recommending that you do so, but, you know, that's part of the civil disobedience actions. So, I mean, from prince to pauper, basically, you know, the homeless, the big issue. A big article on GMOs, and nobody. In fact, the original ripping up the crops action started in Germany quite a long time ago, and when it got to the UK, we already, you know, copycat, but we got quite a lot of attention for it, and from then on, you know, it spread to a lot of other countries. In the U.S., it's happening quite a lot, I understand. I don't know if it's happening here yet or not. But Belgium, it's been happening also. So I was all over Latin America recently, and I can tell you that even Argentina is having second thoughts. So the resistance to GM crops is really, really spreading. It's really a rising tide, and the biotech companies are just desperate. They are desperate. So welcome to the club. You know, Canada is, I think we're going to get there, because now that you've joined us, we're going to be invincible.
Okay, our first speaker on the microphone there, sir.
My name is Arthur Perscher. I'm a physician from Switzerland, and I would like to take the first 55 seconds to make a short statement before I ask Dr. Suzuki a question.
Keep rolling.
Okay. We have in Switzerland already started some 10, 12 years ago to take up the subject of Gentech food and seeds in Switzerland. As a physician, I have worked in the field of gene tech insulin for the last 20 years. And I would like to tell you that our research has showed gene tech insulin can be dangerous to life. There is a syndrome of being dead in bed when one was in good health the night before. And it seems from the lectures I could give here, it is not known that gene tech insulin has major problems. And I took the microphone because Novartis, Aventis, and Lilly were mentioned here. They deal with both. They deal with pharma products, insulin, and seeds. And we have already proof that there is a danger. Now, Dr. Suzuki, shouldn't we, when we have meetings like this, always relate also to health problems in people who take drug made by gene technology? Because the link between drugs and food is a strong one, and people may understand it better that they should be careful and ask questions.
Absolutely. You know, if you go to Haida Gwaii, the Haida people say that food is their medicine. You know, the food, it's astounding to me that we make pharmaceutical companies put their products through a very, very rigorous series of tests. But food, which is something you don't just take for a short period as you do with many drugs, you take it every day and make whatever you're eating into your own body, food is considered something, well, you know, it's far less of a need to be rigorous. I find this absolutely astounding. And of course, the pernicious thing in Canada is that the biotech industry has convinced the government that genetically engineered organisms are food, are no different from regular food. So there isn't the demand for the stringent testing that would be required of drugs. You know, in Europe, what they say is if you want to find out whether GMO food is dangerous, just watch the Canadians. They're doing the experiment for us because we've been eating it for 4 years.
Thank you. I'll go to the balcony. Okay. Sir.
No, my question really has to do with the federal election that's going on right now and whether your people have reviewed the platforms of the parties and whether any of them are addressing GMOs as an issue.
We've got this information on our website, I believe, because we have done a report card. But let's be very honest, that hasn't been an issue in the debates. I mean, it's not as if it's a leading issue. And I guess we're all pretty disappointed in the fact that it's become such a basic election where Chrétien says it's between me and somebody worse, and people seem to be buying that. And therefore, the level of debate about all of these issues is so terribly shallow. So, distressingly, it doesn't appear that this issue or a number of other key issues that we should be debating are going to be on the out in the public realm in this election. It's very disappointing.
I'm going to go to this mic and then back to there.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll go to that speaker there.
Yes, my name is Colleen Fuller. I have two really quick questions, but before I say that, I want to thank the panel. I found your presentations to be very moving and actually very provocative as well. These are my questions. First of all, Dr. Suzuki, and I'm not saying that you should answer this. This is a general question that anybody who can answer it, I would appreciate. Dr. Suzuki said that, or referred to more rigorous testing for drugs, that drugs have been more rigorously tested than food, I'm presuming that you meant. And I'm wondering what is meant by rigorous testing, because I don't agree with that statement, actually. I'm not sure, I'm not sure if I do. Secondly, Maud, you said that the WTO treats GE foods as equivalent to non-GE foods. And I found this a very interesting statement, observation, because it sort of underscores the approach to some of the GE drugs that are being introduced on the market, that they are equivalent to non-GE drugs. And in fact, when synthetic insulin, rDNA insulin, was introduced in 1982, it was introduced as quote-unquote human insulin and continues to be referred to as human insulin. So my question is, does the WTO treat GE drugs as equivalent to non-GE drugs? Thank you.
Okay.
Before you leave, what part don't you agree with, that food, that drugs are not treated rigorously, or that food, GE food, is?
I think that when drugs are introduced onto the market, GE drugs specifically, that there has not been rigorous testing. There hasn't been a rigorous approval process. There hasn't been a rigorous testing process.
Okay, I was referring to food, GE food. that basically Canada's position is it's no different from regular food. So it doesn't have to go through any rigors. Yeah. But you're saying it also applies to GE drugs. I don't know. I didn't know that.
Yeah, trust me.
But we just had the doctor from Switzerland who says, you see, the assumption is always that you've got DNA, which specifies the order of amino acids. And as long as you have the amino acid sequence in the right way so that it's human sequence, then it's the same as human insulin. But of course, we know that there are folding patterns and tertiary and quaternary levels of organization that we don't have the same kind of understanding. And clearly, the clinical results are it ain't human insulin. I mean,
thank you. Mark?
Just very briefly, yes, it's the same principle. It's all based on a notion very firmly established in trade law, all PPMs, is process and production methods. And basically, the understanding is that you cannot discriminate against an import based on how it was made, how it was harvested. So, tuna is tuna, whether it was caught in a net that kills dolphins or not. Corn is corn, whether it was grown organically or genetically engineered. And insulin is insulin, no matter how it was made. It's the product that's in front of you has to be treated equally. And that includes whether it was made in conditions of sweatshops or where terrible human rights abuses were taking place. A rose is a rose is a rose once it's there, and you cannot discriminate.
Okay. Up to the balcony.
Regarding people affected by GMO corn and other GMO products, where could one go for information on studies regarding that information for symptoms and data?
Actually, we have just put out ISIS has just put out a review written by Professor Joe Cummins on all these BT toxin genes. It's on the ISIS website. www.i-sis.org.
Thank you.
Okay. You're next in line.
Okay. Thanks. Sure. Good evening. My name is John Irwin. I'm a PhD student at UBC in Resource Management and Environmental Studies. I think that the debate is really good, and I'm really happy to see it beginning in Canada. My fear is that it becomes a little too anthropocentric at times, when we should be facing directly and squarely questions such as, what right do we have as a species to do this to other species? For instance, in Montreal, there are experiments where they're blasting spider genes into goat genes to make an extruded material to use for sutures. So instead of having cotton sutures, you'll have this suture in your arm, and when you go into the hospital, how will you refuse this suture? You won't know because you're bleeding in an emergency situation. And so I would like to see the debate move to that level. Like, Nietzsche said, God is dead, and now are we saying we are God? And I think we have to really face this squarely, that we're messing around with the fundamental building blocks of all life, including human life. And Dr. Ho, or whoever can address that.
Let me assure you that the debate has indeed moved to that. Michael Fox is somebody who has written an excellent book called Beyond Evolution on this whole issue, on animal welfare. And yes, what happens is that animals are being treated as bioreactors, and they are being exploited to produce pharmaceuticals and industrial chemicals, not only in their milk, in their blood, urine, and semen as well. So these are, another aspect of this kind of mechanistic science gone out of control. So I agree with you.
Thank you. Balcony, sir.
Hello, my name is Noam Dolgan, and I'm with Adam Vadama, which is a Jewish environmental organization here in Vancouver. And I was just wondering, someone actually asked part of the question, but if there has been a response, either locally or internationally, by any of the faith communities to the issues of genetic engineering and to the manipulation of God's creation. Thank you.
Can anyone speak to that?
I think the religious community is actually divided. I have met some theologians that really frighten me. They say, what's wrong with playing God? We are meant to play God because we are made in the image of God. So I don't think religions have kind of a monopoly on morals and moral feelings. So I'm not a religious person.
Excuse me real quick, but on the other hand, the Bible says, do not mix species.
Your turn, ma'am.
My name is Olga Schwarzkopf, and I'm here asking or making a comment based on my work as a paralegal in criminal law. And David Suzuki's presentation has prompted me to stand up to say a few words. Recently, there was a case here in British Columbia where a murder occurred, and over 600 people had to come forward and give their DNA in order to prove they had not committed the crime. The DNA that was extracted from these citizens remains within the DNA bank of the RCMP. This is not only in the RCMP, this is Dade County Police in Florida, California, all over the world. The police departments are gathering DNA material on the citizens of their communities, and they keep it. And we cannot seem to do anything to prevent them from keeping the DNA. As the RCMP and the police forces worldwide hire more scientists, we have no way of knowing what the ultimate use of this DNA is going to be. When the government had asked some professors at the University of Alberta to investigate the ethical issues related with DNA testing in the criminal law, and when I phoned them to present my argument about the problem here, they couldn't see anything wrong with this and that it was not on their agenda to be included in the discussion. The other aspect of this is that what is to prevent them from using this DNA of the various citizens, whether they're incarcerated or not, and then drawing conclusions about who these people are and what they represent. It causes me a great deal of concern, but nobody's talking about it.
Does anyone on the panel want to address that?
Well, as you well know, there was a case recently of the Nechanoth on Vancouver Island who gave their blood to an Oxford professor because they were interested in the genetics of arthritis. And then years later, they discovered that he'd gone off the project, hadn't told them the results, and was using it for something totally different. I mean, the opportunity for this kind of abuse of trust, I think, is immense.
Okay. I don't know if anybody from the Council of Responsible Genetics is here, but this group has drafted an excellent genetic bill of rights in order to protect these invasion of human rights and privacy, and also, you know, to preserve the biodiversity of the planet.
I'm Phil Bariano from the Council for Responsible Genetics. Actually, in the U.S., the issue that the woman raises, there have been a number of us on it for quite some time. There are books, there are articles. The American Civil Liberties Union, I'm also on their board, has been involved in this. You can get information on it from the Council of Responsible Genetics website, which is www.gene-watch.org. Or you can go, if you're interested in issues of genetic discrimination and so forth, to the American Civil Liberties Union website, which is www.aclu.org. There is quite a literature on it. We've had litigation in the States, and we've not been successful. The U.S. Department of Defense also has a similar program. I don't know about the Canadian Armed Services, in which every member of the military and the civilian office employees have their DNA taken and stored in a bank for 50 years, supposedly so there never will be an unknown soldier. This is obviously a nonsensical rationale. We've represented people whose refused to participate in it with in litigation. There's been varying effects and so forth. So there is quite a rich story out there. And the fact that we're neighbors and we don't sort of know this is a real shame. So we need to trade this information more readily.
Great. Thank you. Back to the balcony.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Eric Lascarbo. I'm with a group called Gene Action in Victoria. We've been involved in organizing grocery store rallies and all sorts of stuff like that in Victoria. I won't go into all the details. But I just wanted to say to the scientists on the panel, I'm incredibly inspired. I was a student of biochemistry at the University of Victoria for 4 years. I haven't quite finished my degree, we'll go into that, but I really lost faith in the science, but I also sort of became a political activist, and that's part of the reason why I haven't finished my degree. But and I just wanted to say that I find that your vision of what science could be and what's the kind of role the scientists can play in society incredibly inspiring. And one of the things I think that this issue has really been about is about democracy, and it really shows that if we can't even have the right to know what's in our food, what an incredibly undemocratic society we live in. After being I had the opportunity last year, a year ago almost today, to travel down to Seattle and take part in the mobilization of 50,000 people marching through the streets of Seattle to oppose the World Trade Organization and all of the undemocratic principles for which they stand. I just wanted to let people know that in April of next year in Quebec City, French and English workers, men and women, again, will have a chance to stand together to oppose the free trade area of the Americas, and we'll have a chance to take our little piece of democracy onto the streets and have our voice. I don't know if people have heard about the FTAA, but it's basically the extension of NAFTA into South America, and all of the things that NAFTA and free trade stood for and that the WTO stands for. Well, this is basically the same thing on steroids. So if you want to get your piece of democracy, go to Quebec City on April 21st and take part.
Thank you. Next speaker, go ahead.
Are all organic foods GMO free?
So far.
You're about to get an answer.
By definition, they're supposed to be. There's always, and I personally buy them for a number of reasons, one of which is it's a safe way to feed my family to be reasonably sure that they are GMO free. But it must be said that if their crops are grown within pollination distance of GM crops, there is the potential for cross-contamination, and this is a significant issue for organic farmers. It's a significant issue for any conventional grower who is trying to get a GMO free premium. You may not know that there is actually a premium paid for grain that is GMO free, and that premium is lost if there is contamination from a GM crop. And be aware that in canola pollen travels 8 kilometers on the form of vectors, the pollinators and so on. So technically it's supposed to be GMO free, which is one good reason to buy it. It's the only way to be sure you're not gonna get it, but it's never 100%.
Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Arzina Hamir, and I'm an agronomist. And first of all, I'd like to thank everyone on the panel for taking the time to come today and speak to us. I would also like to follow up on Rukshana's comment about scientists who work in universities, who work for the government, not being able to speak out. I've, in my own profession, know many people who do not agree with the fact or the statement that genetically engineered crops are safe, but they're unable to speak out because of fear of losing their jobs, of fear of not getting tenure at universities. So if, you know, some members of the panel can possibly give ideas of how to make a safe place for scientists to speak out, what we as a society can do to enable more people to speak out. I get the impression that the majority of lay people think that all scientists are behind genetic engineering, that we all think it's safe, and we think people who don't agree with it are just backwards. And I want more scientists to speak out. I think Dr. Ho, you mentioned a number of 430 scientists, or however many from 43 different countries. That's
370.
That's a paltry number of scientists. In 43 countries, if only 300 you know, scientists can speak out, where are the rest of them, and why aren't they talking, and how can we get them to speak out?
Thank you.
Well, I think, you know, people ought to remember that when Linus Pauling decided to warn people about the effects of atmospheric testing, this is a man who already had a Nobel Prize in chemistry, who was the chairman of the department at Caltech, and he began to speak out in a very informed way. He lost his passport, he lost his grant, and eventually he lost his position as the chair. So here's a man, you know, eventually won two Nobel Prizes, but you see the impact of speaking out on a man with those kinds of credentials. It's easy to understand why a junior faculty member is not going to speak out.
Other panel members?
Please. Let me just comment briefly. I think Dr. Suzuki spoke earlier about waiting until you have your reputation established before you speak out. And that is an unfortunate reality if you want to stay in academia, and you may not. I served as the chair of the Status of Women Committee at University of Guelph for several years, and one of the more disturbing things that I found, and this may have been true of men as well as women, but I heard about the women, is finishing women PhD students who decline to apply for academic positions because they have seen us and they don't want to be like us. And I think this is a particularly alarming long-term trend that I think we need to be cognizant of. It's not simply relating to speaking out on genetic engineering or nuclear testing or whatever the issue might be, but there is a whole culture that actively discourages and discriminates and so on against doing what we as tenured faculty members are supposed to be doing. We are paid to be the critics of society. That's what tenure is supposed to allow you to do. By definition, we are serving our clients, which is you. You are paying our salaries. So when conditions are placed where the barrier between outside and inside university is blurred, and outside becomes inside, which is what corporatization means, then a great deal is very close to being lost, and it's not just about genetic engineering. So I think this is something that people should be thinking about in the degree to which they allow this corporatization thing to continue.
I just want to say a few words, and I think it's necessary, it's very necessary, to introduce into the debate, back into the debate, the notion of social accountability of science and scientists, because that has gone completely by the board. The whole culture of science and the whole culture of science has changed, and it, you know, social accountability, social responsibility, the public good, never ever mentioned anymore. Now, if we actually brought this kind of debate back, I think that this would make science, this would redeem science, this would begin to decorporatize science again, that insist on no matter where, who they are working for, it doesn't matter who pays their salaries, we must insist that they have the obligation to speak out, to tell the truth. Because you can argue that if Monsanto had let their scientists tell the truth, I don't know if they had, but you know, if they hadn't, they should have, then they wouldn't have got themselves into such a lot of trouble. They wouldn't have see their whole company collapse. So in the long term, you know, it pays to have scientists who can tell the truth. And that's the bottom line.
Maude, you want to comment?
I, it's clear this got a reaction. It's a very important question. I would say that the question also has to go to non-scientists and citizens who have to play our part, because if we leave people alone to face a wrathful university or a community that's going to cut their livelihood off and say, well, gee, that's the way it is, we're negligent and we can't expect that to be. I want you to be happy with us that Shiv Chopra and Margaret Hayden and that whole group have won their gag order, the court case against a gag order, and now they're speaking out again. I can tell you Shiv Chopra speaking out forcefully. And I think he would agree if he were here that he did that partly because he felt supported by a whole community of groups and people, particularly in Ottawa where he lives. And I want to be positive. I want us to know that there are some really important things. Studies tell us, or polls tell us, that in Canada, of people who know about GMOs, 75% have serious concerns, 94%, this is from a Council of Canadians poll, believe that governments and societies have the right to control it, including the control of and even banning of imports, even if they don't have proven concerns, but just concerns, and 95% want mandatory labeling. And I will remind us that we won the bovine growth hormone fight in this country. So there is a citizens' movement out there, and don't deny the progressive faith community, because they've also been there with us in this country.
You've been listening to a forum, Genetically Engineer This, part of the teach-in, Big Money, Bad Science, given in Vancouver, Canada on November 10th. Thanks to the Vancouver Indie Media Center for recording this event. The panel is also available via their website at www.vancouver.indymedia.org. Are you concerned about how to avoid GMOs in your food? An online guide to GMO content of supermarket brands is available at truefoodnow.org. That's truefoodnow.org. The music used in today's program was Bigger, Better, Brighter by Seize the Day.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. The rich will come.